Thank you for listening to the Content Magazine podcast, Conversations with Silicon Valley's Creatives, published by SV Creates.
Hello, welcome to the Content Magazine podcast. I'm Daniel Garcia, the cultivator of Content Magazine, published by SV Creates. And we're super honored today to have Jonathan Borca with us here in our SOFA studio. Jonathan is a performer, a rapper, the deputy director at School of Arts and Culture at Mexican Heritage Plaza, just a community leader. Oh, and also you are currently on the City of San Jose Arts Commission Board.
That's right. That's right.
Is there anything you don't do? You
were That's on the, more. That's
you were
more.
With Local Color for a while, too, like on the board for Local Color.
Yeah, I did a three-year term. So I think that ended last December.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was on their board, too.
Yeah. And then I saw, too, that you actually worked for the San Jose Downtown Association.
I did. Yep.
Yeah. So you have been...
Around the block,
connected in what's going on in San Jose. But before we get to that, I want to kind of like see, because I know that you had lived, I guess your dad was in the Air Force, so you traveled around, and you were raised, or your early years were in Japan.
Yeah.
Right? So like from what to about seven till you moved to San Jose?
Yeah. So it's I'll give you a slightly abbreviated story leading into that. So I'm Mexican-Filipino.
Yeah.
My mom is Mexican, and she was born in San Jose. She met my father, who immigrated from the Philippines, when he was a teenager at a church in San Jose. I think the church was Eastside Church of Christ, so also in Eastside.
Yeah.
And then they hit it off early. There were a bunch of kids, and the story kind of goes like my great-grandma, so my father's grandma was just trying to get him acclimated to the language because he spoke pretty broken English.
Oh, okay.
But what started as a social experiment became love. So they were like, okay, get away. So the joke is like my great-grandma in broken English or in a Filipino accent. Okay, that's enough. Leave him alone now.
Leave him alone.
But anyway, they really hit it off. They had kids early. I'm one of three. So I'm the middle child.
Okay, all right.
My brother Daniel is the eldest. And then my youngest sister is Kimberlyn. Okay. So Daniel was born here, San Jose.
Okay.
And then because my dad joined the military, the Air Force, as you mentioned, He moved around a bit. So they went from San Jose to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I was actually born in Albuquerque.
Okay, yeah.
I think sometimes people assume I'm born and raised in San Jose. And even though I'm really proud of that identity, I was actually born in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And my sister was too.
Okay.
Then we moved over to Japan.
Yeah.
So he was in the Aomori province.
Okay.
And it's a little murky. Like I was, I think like 5 to 7.
Okay, so a couple
maybe,
of years.
Yeah. Uh-huh, maybe 6 to 8, something around then.
Did you first start school then in Japan? But it was probably like an American
English-speaking.
So you don't speak Japanese or
learn I know a couple words. But it was at in bases that were very much like American-based families.
Yeah.
But the foil was like you know, the memories I recall are like going to downtown or the beautiful cherry blossoms, the impeccable candy, gum. Like Japan had like the coolest variety of gum flavors. So those things I remember pretty vividly, but mostly I was around American families.
Okay. Would you say, though, I mean, so if looking back, like you looked at your life and where you are now, if you looked at that time, like kind of like that, you know, 5 to 7 is kind of formative years in a way, right?
For sure.
But would you say that, you know, you don't really see that as being a significant part of you, who you are? Or how does that play? I mean, definitely San Jose is, and we'll get to that. But
I
just want to kind of, on this little slice real quick.
No, great question. I'm going to interview you at some point today. No, it was definitely transformative. So I think the life event of note is that they actually separated at that point. So
In Japan. Okay.
So it was in 95 when we all moved. My siblings moved to East San Jose.
Okay.
In the house that my mom grew up in, that my grandparents had lived in since like the 70s.
Okay.
So transformative in the sense of like fond memories.
Sure.
But really when I think about like what defined my identity and how did I find my grounding and who raised me, like all credit. And I have a great relationship with my dad still.
Yeah.
He's been very active throughout our lives and is currently.
Yeah.
But my mom, she raised us. She was and I've shared this before, but she was a single teenage mother raising three kids, right? So from Japan to Eastside.
Yeah.
With heck of help from my grandparents, thankfully. And I truly feel like we always got the love we needed, and we're super privileged compared to even some of our neighborhood folks because we had so much. But
family connections.
And I mean, access to grandparents, a lot of love, great models of hard work ethic, being community oriented, wearing your heart on your sleeve. So things that really like took me into adulthood to even realize, oh, I take these for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, the identity that I would say, I know we will probably touch on San Jose more, but like Eastside to me is like one of the identities I always wear on my sleeve.
Because you grew up more Alum Rock, in Alum Rock areas.
Right? I grew up on the, arguably the other side of Eastside. So I grew up near King Story.
Okay.
I grew up on Hopkins Drive.
Okay.
So, because I just feel like those were the years like post divorce and separation that triggered a lot of things that are important to who I am today. So like, when you think about music or art, which maybe people experience me as at this stage of my life, like it was my mom who gave me Tupac's Greatest Hits as a kid.
She was
progressive and young, and she liked hip hop and she liked Motown.
Right on.
My dad liked Nirvana.
Yeah, okay.
And
full mix.
And rock. And so we were kind of surrounded by music predominantly, and then art not too far later.
Yeah, and music then at that point, like... because come in and you were kind of like hip hop became kind of like your refuge, right? To deal with some of your angst and anger and the adjustments, of course, we go through life. Was that
who are you speaking to, Daniel? Okay,
right.
Who said it? Who's lying?
Absolutely.
So
yeah, and did so. You did, was that in a way that you even thought like, oh, I want to do this? Like you were starting to, you know, create your own beats and rhymes and all that kind of stuff, even at an early age?
Yeah, spot on. So I think what may or may not surprise you, depending on how well you know me, I was a bit of the problem child.
Okay.
So my brother Daniel was like super intelligent, incredible work ethic, was very responsible in some ways, kind of helped raise the younger siblings.
Yeah.
Currently a DA, so took the LSAT once, scored in the top percentile in the nation, went to UCLA, went to UC San Diego in undergrad. So he was very hardworking, focused.
Yeah.
I think in some ways, like, I like, he wouldn't like this, but I parallel Daniel a little bit towards my dad, and I'm a little bit more like my mom.
Okay.
So my dad was also regimented. You know, he's impeccable ethic, military clean, disciplined.
Yeah. Right.
Cooks very well. None of those I have, but innately. And then my mom, and I'll get to your question on, like, how I practiced early.
Yeah.
My mom is like all heart. So many people make fun of me that you're like, you're twins. And I used to hate to admit that. And now, honestly, I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah.
So she'll give her shirt off her back if she didn't have more than one to give.
Yeah,
awesome. She cares deeply. She'll serve people even above herself. So those are some of the qualities I think I have
sister get, your little sister get?
The perfect middle.
Okay, so all right. So she got the mix between the two.
Absolutely. And you know, me and Daniel are like, I'm really proud to have a brother like Daniel. And we're very different in ways.
Yeah,
but Kimberlyn, I find, is the perfect medium. So she has like the intellectual capacity of Daniel,
the
intelligence and the heart and kind of the artistic quality that I have.
So you know what, though? I'm going to stop you right there.
Because
you can't sell yourself short because you were able to get like a scholarship to go to Bellarmine, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a young age to be in high school. So you have obviously, and all the stuff that you've done, you do have some drive, some passion, some discipline. Mm. Right? I mean,
but
just less than your brother.
no, exactly.
Or did you develop that? And was it? Yeah, tell me a little about that.
Yeah, you know what? Your intuition is spot on. So like I think a lot of the complex that I had to deal with earlier, really in those years of elementary, middle school, high school.
Yeah.
It was like, oh boy, I'm being compared to my brother again, right?
Yeah,
or like,
totally.
He went to Fisher, and actually he went to Bellarmine on a completely different scholarship.
Oh, okay.
Really on his own merit.
All right.
I was a part of a widespread recruitment effort that the Eastside staff had a connection to.
Okay.
And so he brought the largest class maybe ever and probably since.
Okay.
Of like 30 Eastsiders.
Okay.
In Alum Rock School District into Bellarmine.
Okay.
And we were all given a academic scholarship.
Yeah.
So not to take away from the compliment and honestly, it's like something that I learned in adulthood was like, who wins when we compare?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
My brother has so much talent and special gifts and I have some too. And in fact, like, me holding that better at this age is still a practice. But like my brother, as much as I'm rapping about my brother now, he would ad nausea say, oh, you know, this is the cooler brother and would be really complimentary. So
yeah,
I think,
yeah, yeah.
I think you're right. It's like standing in hold of who you are.
Yeah.
And then knowing that, like, I'm just fans. Like, I'm a fan of art. I'm a fan of music. Before I was a performer, I was a fan.
I'm
a fan of people. So I'm a fan of my brother and my sister, right?
Yeah. So then actually, I want to go back a little bit, touch on that. So the Bellarmine Scholarship, was that, I mean, that was something you just got picked for? Or somebody, I mean, obviously somebody saw something in you. And, of course, they were trying to fit some kind of program. And they had to select people, but you were one to get selected, right? So, which is, says something about you, even though you were the troubled youth.
Bribery, Daniel. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, for the record. No, their intent was really to diversify and to have, like, stronger community engagement practices.
Yeah.
So they did have a pretty rigorous process. Okay. There was, like, you needed to be referred from your counselor. You needed to meet with the staff who was at Bellarmine at the time, who frankly was the one that allowed this opportunity to happen.
Yeah.
And then you had to have, I think there were some other hard requirements, Probably like a certain GPA. You had to take, like, the standard exam for Bellarmine. You had to do a pretty robust application process.
Yeah.
And then it was, I try to think about how to publicly speak about Bellarmine in a way that is true and appreciative and rooted in gratitude and honest on, like, my experience wasn't all great.
Yeah.
You tell anyone, hey, I went to Bellarmine, they're like, aha.
Right.
Sneaky, privileged guy, huh? Lucky you.
Sure, yeah. There's the kind of that thing. I mean, yeah. You even see it in downtown. Some of the people that are in leadership is like Bellarmine, you know, some of the mayors and stuff like this. Like
movers and shakers, current mayor. There's a lineage. So I think what I would add to, like, give a fuller picture is we were kind of Gen 1. Right. So my brother did it on an Italian scholarship that was for all 4 years.
Yeah.
We got in because of the staff and we were qualified to get in.
Yeah.
But it was year to year. So even that on its face, like,
all right,
maybe in hindsight, not the best format to, like, allow for access with these parameters. Right. We had to work for the scholarship. We had to make phone calls. We had to do other requirements that weren't required of other students.
Yeah.
Now, I don't say that with disdain because you got to start somewhere. Right.
Yeah.
But it
phone
was,
call. What do you mean? You had to make phone calls, like, to raise money for Bellarmine.
No,
or something like
you
that?
Would do, like, dashboard. So, like, relatively easy work. But in hindsight, you know, as an adult, I'm like, oh boy, like, wait, you shouldn't. The students add who need extra. More help shouldn't have to do more.
Yeah,
right.
Right? Especially if you're coming already from, you know, maybe not as much support at home because parents are working more because of lower incomes. Yeah, and then to add extra duties on top.
Uh huh.
Right. Kind of seems like it's almost like setting them up to fail in a way. But you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't. Yeah, here's the other unfun stat of, like, the 30 or so. How many do you think would have graduated?
I would say 2%.
Okay, good. That's all right. Good guess. So, like, probably 5 or 6 of us actually graduated.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not a compelling stat. And when I talk about Bellarmine, like, I realize I'm not as proud because I know this truth. Like, I didn't feel smarter than anyone. And I went to Fisher Middle School. I didn't feel like I was the brightest. I didn't feel like I worked the hardest. I feel like a lot of it was just luck.
And a little bit of, like, survivor guilt in a way. I would kind of like to
maybe to your earlier point, like, maybe I need to, like, just be a little bit more steadfast and confident in my merit and who I am. But I also think, like, well, it would have been great to have graduated with my peers, all 30 of us, because they were just as capable and competent and. It to me, that story there is like, how did we fail the students at from the Alum Rock district, which is already under resourced,
So you had music influence, and then this Bellarmine experience, though, going from kind of like East Side ish, and then going over to Bellarmine with this poshy kind of like situation, that's started to shape kind of like who you are today, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so that's where I want to, like, delineate, like, what my experience was to how grateful I am. So my mom was so progressive that, like, even in middle school, we didn't have a curfew. So my mom would let me be up at midnight in other East Side homes.
Oh, yeah.
If we always did our work.
Yeah, okay.
And we showed up strong the next day.
Cool, yeah.
And we've had autonomy since we were kids. So, like, we didn't act wild in college, or we don't do things out of character now.
Yeah.
I think in part because of my mom's philosophy.
Yeah. So I'm gonna stop you then there. So even when you say that you were the black sheep, how bad were you really?
Let's go back there.
Okay. So
pretty
bad.
Pretty bad. More. So anyone know any of my current friends from Eastside who know me, this will tell you that I'm a different person. That's how dramatic it would be.
Okay.
So I went to you don't really get kicked out of elementary school. I went to three different elementaries.
Okay. So they moved you around because you were kind of like, okay, maybe this other environment will be better for him.
Yeah.
Because there'll be less friends for him to. That kind of thing?
The remarks were consistent. It was like behavioral issues, angry, fights a lot.
Okay.
I actually always did pretty well academically. I felt like I don't know, like I had a knack for writing compared to my peers. But bad in a cheeky sense where like I was never a bad kid. Like I was raised with a lot of ethics that my mom instilled, but like she would, you know, like I'll give you an example. If a teacher called me a liar or accused me of something and I didn't do it, my mom kind of instilled early, you stand up and you deny that.
Okay.
And then my mom, in one case, and I won't say which elementary school, we had a parent conference because it was a similar thing like that where like I was charged with something that I definitely didn't do.
Yeah.
And then my mom turned and said, son, did you do this or did you not? I said, no, she told me to, if I didn't like it, I can leave. You know, I'm like a third or fourth grader.
Yeah.
And so I left the class.
Yeah.
And my mom turned to the principal and to the teacher and said, my son is a lot of things, but he does not lie. And she's like, this meeting is done. We got what we needed out of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think I was just a kid who needed direction, and tying back my relationship with music and art and poetry.
Yeah.
It was always very private. It was for me.
Okay.
So my Nana and my mom really get credit for raising me.
Yeah.
And they did a bunch of things. I think they talked to friends and physicians. They were like, okay, let's get him a pet. So we had a bunch of dogs growing up, and we're all animal lovers in part because of it. Or let's get him into sports, right? I wrestled for a little bit, but I loved basketball more. I just wasn't good at it.
Yeah.
And then it clicked just like that.
Yeah.
So literally imagine a second, third, fourth, fifth grader kind of experiencing an atypical amount of behavioral issues. It was my mom just like, funny enough, it was just my mom being my mom that worked.
Yeah.
So she gave me like, I can name three albums that I think shaped my trajectory.
Okay, lay them on us. Yeah, what are they?
Okay, so Arrested Development, not the TV show, you know. their debut album, 3 months, six, or 3 years, 6 months, and whatever days in the life of. Beautiful album. It's speech is like a vocalist who doesn't fit cleanly in a box. So he's like a rapper, but he's a singer. It was very much about Afrocentricity. So like self-love was a pretty dominant theme.
Yeah.
And you'll start to see how kind of like I've taken influence from these folks.
Yeah.
Then she gave me Tupac's Greatest Hits.
Yeah.
Talk about a progressive mom. Third or fourth grade, she gave me those two albums, right?
Yeah.
And then I want to say the last one was, and she was really thoughtful. And I think she was a young teenage mom trying to figure out what would resonate with her kids.
Yeah.
One year she gave all of us a album, I think it was for Christmas, and mine was New Edition, Home Again. So these weird three albums are really on their face. They're not super comparable, but like it was at that moment, along with like a poetry book she gave me, where I want to say I wrote my first rap in third grade.
Okay. All right.
And it stuck. I started writing poetry, and Tupac also had a poetry book, A Rose That Grew From Concrete. So I was kind of copying Tupac.
Yeah, sure.
Wrote all these poems about girls I had crushes on, and it started really, really early. But the irony is you can almost see like a clear through line of how me being introduced to music, my behavior just started to align with like how I did academically.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So do you have journals of like early writings and stuff like that, or like a stack of papers or this long lost
bin?
Do you have any kind of like those kind of things in the archives?
I got to see if my mom does, because I had like probably an obnoxious amount of poetry as a kid.
Yeah.
But I literally had journals that were all just poems.
Yeah, so that's cool.
I feel like I actually write more poetry than rap, but I perform more rap. So people, and poetry is like a hard identity. You have like Mighty Mike and Shotgun Campbell and Yossi Mata. So I've been cautious around carrying that identity, but I'm leaning into it a little bit more.
But I mean, all lyrics, right? And rap is poetry, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. It's just different kind of venue, platform, and stuff like that.
Like you can say rap is broken poetry.
Yeah.
Right? You may not have iambic pentameter, but
totally.
MCs like Elzai or anyone, I almost think like you can aesthetically, the average ear can hear the aesthetic nuance and may not see that if you were to break it down, there's actually a 3-4-3 pattern here.
Yeah.
Which is very derivative of what I think is like similar in poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're fitting it to a beat, then it's going to have some kind of like common, and even like using, you know, all kinds of different literary verbal cues of either like sound or, you know, syllables, you know, it's all plays into it. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So, okay, so now, but it seemed like what I've researched in depth on your life, but you end kind of like because of the experience of the Bellarmine, you started to get a little bit more community minded and focused. And because, you know, even though you're a poet, you're a rapper, you're a performer, I mean, you're really a community leader, builder, developer, right?
Yeah, I mean, probably more than my creative identity, in which people have known me the last 3 to 4 years. Right?
Yeah, I think, I think like a like a community developer, even your music, you know, is like you're bringing a band together, right? You're bringing the new video that Jezreel shot, which is like super cool. Mike McGee's in it. You like, and you're bringing together like the Seventh Street Band or your band, right? You're bringing those kind of players together. That's still building a community. And then you're saying things that are uplifting a community. So tell me about how that bug got into you to do stuff for the community.
And thank you. That's like a high compliment, because I'm not sure I'm always like trying to have that through line, but it is super important.
It's
for me.
So,
like,
I
get so much joy out of curating and like bringing people together and having like messaging that I truly want to believe in.
Yeah.
It's not easy. I can complain like the best of them.
But
I'm glad that that's coming out.
You've done a couple of events even too, like the, with the Mexican Heritage Plaza, bring in some different events. So anyways, how'd you get that bug?
No, thank you. So I think you're right that there was a kind of a launching point for not the artist, but the professional career at Bellarmine.
Okay.
And it was easy for me because it was visceral. So I saw early, really in eighth grade and as early as freshman year, that there was gross inequities between Overfeld and Bellarmine.
Yeah.
I would have gone to Overfeld, right? I would have, and then I ended up going to Bellarmine.
Yeah.
And some of the dopest people I know, we like my class at who went to Overfeld, friends who I still like remain in contact with.
Yeah.
We have doctors, we have incredible teachers, we have engineers. So I don't mean to say that anything is wrong on his face about Overfeld, but to me it was just not fair. As a kid, I'm saying, wait, we have a state-of-the-art library at Bellarmine, we have an incredible gym, we have a swimming pool, we have like 20 AP classes, and in contrast, Overfeld at the time probably had 3. So to me, that was the launching pad for the community work. And I thought the vehicle for it, well, it is and has been the nonprofit sector. But originally, at that young age, it was, okay, I need to do nonprofits that have an education reform emphasis. Because this is awesome and great, and I have access and privilege. And over here, they don't have that. And the beauty would be if those two worlds kind of met somewhere in the middle. So yeah, I actually started working nonprofit jobs in high school, which is why, like, I mean, not that people would know it, but I've been in the nonprofit sector now 14 or 15 years. So if you do the math, you do my age. It's because I started nearly full-time in high school on. So yeah, I was in it was called Avanti Foundation. That was the very kind of first nonprofit that I started in high school. It was a cohort-based nonprofit.
Wait a second. You started it?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Oh, okay. You started at. Okay.
Started working.
No, this was going to go to a total different level. Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, I was in high school and I started a nonprofit. I'm like, okay, all right.
No.
No,
I did not. I did not start that nonprofit. Okay. But yeah, I mean, that was like a near peer approach to working with a group of students that had started in elementary and followed them through high school.
Awesome.
So it was early, and most of the things have been education reform. Then I jumped to, like, I guess the other part of that is, like, where does the advocacy come in? Where does the fun development experience? That's maybe the other wrinkle in my resume. Is that I had never formally fundraised, but there was, like, students who I followed all through Eastside into Bellarmine. I was like, hey, like, I have a responsibility to make sure that, like, these two students that I know in Pocoway, like, have a friend. That they have someone who can help navigate it. And because their families were monolingual Spanish. And so I, at one point, I even signed on as a, not as a guardian, but basically
a sponsor type.
Where they allowed me to send in all the counseling, and I would show up for them. And so that was, like, really my genesis story of, like, learning how to fundraise or advocacy, because I was like, wait, they have less money than I had. Very modest means. They one income, immigrant parents, and Bellarmine didn't give them the full ride that I got. So I was like, hold on, you're 5K short. Let's roll up our sleeve. Let's organize and have a fundraiser, and then let's have another fundraiser. And then carry that all the way through Downtown Association. That's where I credit a lot of what I learned about, like sponsorship,
yeah.
right? And working with small businesses is yeah. another wrinkle. And so that, long story less long, is really the different buckets that I fell into professionally are because yeah. are very much around that same launching pad of high school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then, okay, so now you have this kind of like this nonprofit advocacy, education, mm-hmm. moving to fundraising, working mm-hmm. with nonprofits or organizations. And then the music, where's the music in this whole kind of like track? Is it,
yeah.
it's in the closet in the bedroom kind of back? Or is it like, are you, tell me about how that, because yeah. now you're putting out videos and performing all over the place. So where did that kind of like merge together?
Yeah, great, like great, great question. Because it was, okay, so taking it back to the story of how I got introduced to music, it was very insular. It was for me, right?
Yeah.
I wrote
yeah.
alone. And mm-hmm. then I would like, we would beatbox and rap in the Fisher sure. Middle School hallway, so that was like very yeah. common, but it was very much around my art, right?
Yeah.
And it was for me predominantly.
Yeah,
that I think people may or may not be surprised that like I wasn't public with my art well into probably my 30s. So like I'm currently 36, but college I think was the first time I performed with the band publicly.
Okay,
like and it was like senior year in college.
Yeah,
so like I that's probably the very first time that I like was sharing publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Soon after, I think I created an Instagram because I used to be kind of shameful of my art, right? So I had a private account. I didn't put my name in the band because I always thought like I wasn't as cool as like many of the people I looked up to in this space, like Amy and Ren and all these people that yeah. like were okay. foundational in jazz, but who people that I looked up to, Jonah Melvan,
yeah.
right? Like all these folks who were movers and shakers. And so Francis Experience is like its own conundrum. It's bad branding. But
I know, even I remember the first time that I was trying to contact you. I'm like, hey, Francis.
It's confusing for everybody.
And you're like, actually, it's Jonathan. I'm like, oh, snap.
Yeah.
But I do that with everybody.
Well, it's
but
not,
Francis is your middle name. Or Francisco or Francis, which is the actual.
Yeah, so, okay. So let me, I'll touch on that.
Yeah.
But I'll say, just to close out
yeah.
the conversation on how music became
yeah.
public. Started in college. Did a bunch of the bar scene stuff. Was figuring out my identity. We had like a weird eclectic band, reggae, ska, rap, hip hop.
Yeah. And where was that at? Where were you performing at? Like what?
Every bar in San Jose. And
yeah.
it was I was in a band called Soul Drive, actually with Gabby.
Okay.
Porter,
okay,
the Seventh Street Big Band, is the drummer.
Yeah.
And she's like my one non-negotiable in any bandmate.
Yeah,
she's
cool.
like one of my dearest friends.
Yeah.
And so we were just like a bunch of kids like trying to play music, and we said yes to every single gig we could have.
Yeah.
And then it really wasn't until after the Well, I guess like right before the pandemic that this version that people might see as my artist or the identity that I carry, that barely started in
okay.
like 2019.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because I had a dormant
yeah.
period.
Yeah.
And then I
okay.
was like, okay, I like this band stuff was really fun and it taught me a lot and I learned to be a little bit more confident in my art as rap or
yeah.
poetry. But then bringing back full circle, like what I get joy out of, it's the curation, it's cross medium.
Yeah.
There's things that I love that I just can't do. I can't rap double time. I don't know, I'll never be someone, like I hear Mighty Mike and I think like, my God, you're special, right?
Yeah.
Shaka Campbell, I'm like, oh, y'all are like
yeah.
incredible talent.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
my like version of what I do,
mm-hmm.
it's really me just like trying to take things that I really enjoy and love
yeah.
just as much as my background in hip hop. So
yeah.
the story I'll share is like, I used to go to like Cafe for Scrotty, you know, across
yeah,
from
yeah.
you.
Yeah, open mic stuff.
And yeah, just mm-hmm. to get my poetry fix, and I loved it because it would make me frightfully nervous.
Yeah,
I would be like, oh, I don't always get this when I rap.
Yeah.
So to me, the vulnerability was really key.
Yeah.
Then I would go to like 55 South to hear Alliance and
yeah.
Bernard Sapitola and Bennett Roth,
okay.
and they were jamming. So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
At Fisher Middle School, we would all freestyle in the hallways. Like, let me test my improvisation chops.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then the other piece was like the jazz like affinity that I've always had. So like, I like big band jazz, like. Mr. Hivor at Bellarmine was the first person to introduce me to a lot of people. So like John Coltrane and
yeah.
and Charlie Parker, like
yeah.
I loved all of these things just as well.
Yeah.
And so the real identity of my creative niche, I would say, kind of started around 2019.
Okay.
When I tried to put these things together, and it was very much a working theory of, wait, I'm an East Side kid. Who loves this space in poetry, who loves this improvisation jam band, and who loves jazz. And I'm like, I can't be the only one who's like, woo.
Yeah, right.
Or like thinks this is incredible
yeah.
and throws an arm up in all three spaces.
Right.
And so I said, what would it look like to present a band, but in a better context. And that context to me needed to be theaters, because I didn't see any rapping that was not, that was in theaters, and I didn't see rap regarded as like a high art.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, then let's change the context. Instead of a bar where people are drunk and yelling at you, they're really not listening to your words, like what would it look like to be in a theater?
Yeah.
And then how do you, I was worried about it being a variety show. So sure. I go, how do you integrate jazz and ballet and poetry in the same show?
Yeah.
So I had a lot of influences, but locally it was a thought experiment, but like Wes Anderson as a film director really told color stories, which pertains to like the Museum of Art residency, by the way.
Yeah.
So I noticed how he told a visual story.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to take all these elements, all the things that I love about San Jose, and do a three-act concert experience. And that was the very first attempt that I had in this identity.
Yeah, which one? What was that called? Which that was?
That was just called Francis Experience, which Francis was, Experience. And, you know, it was still, it was like my pseudonym. And in some ways, I think the reality is I was a little bit like still growing into the comfort of holding that identity. So it was like a way to hide in some ways too.
Okay, yeah. Well, so, okay, that wasn't a part of, 'cause what was the series called? Was that Gold? Or
yeah, Color Me Gold.
Color Me Gold. Was that about the same time that that was kind of going on?
Yeah,
that
you
were starting to launch Francis Experience with at that same time?
So that's like a little bit more recent.
Okay.
So here, to put a pin on the Francis Experience production, it taught me a lot right before pandemic. It said, okay, and it was amateur. It didn't flow as good, but I thought that connect a thread through all these different arts, and then the experience from the audience won't feel disjointed. It'll feel like a shared narrative.
Yeah.
So a three-act concert experience to me was just a basic concert in a theater, but I used storytelling elements to bind it together better. And I broke it down by color. Yellow, green, blue was how I classified the types of performance.
Cool.
But also the content. So, you know, one example, like yellow in Wes Anderson films is nostalgic, and it's done in film a lot, right? Or yellow could be the sun.
Yeah,
so I'm like, hey, can you curate your performances, whether it's dance, rap, or jazz, and kind of play with this theme?
Yeah, cool.
So super amateurish, awesome. Pandemic shut down. I went on a break for a while. And then at the Plaza.
Well, you didn't go on a break. You were working at the Plaza, and you guys were pumping out transition to do food distribution. So you took a break from maybe like the energy of going towards music, but you were working.
I was. Yeah. No,
okay.
Thank you.
I don't want
people
to think like you're like playing video games.
Right.
COVID.
This kid is lazy. No. So like I just took a musical break, right?
Yeah.
Because we, and big ups to Jessica Basadillos and Vanessa Shee. They had to make really heady decisions during that time.
Yeah.
We paused all programming at the Mexican Heritage Plaza and became sort of a hub for resources.
Yeah.
So we worked with like Garner Health Services and that came later, but originally we worked with Sacred Heart Community Service, or Second Harvest of Silicon Valley.
Second Harvest or Sacred Heart?
Second Harvest, sorry. Yeah, okay. And then, we just became like a distribution for a food distribution that was touch-free. And then like how it came back to music and Color Me Gold and other things that I've tried to play with our pilot was that I have never worked at an organization that allowed me to have all of these identities.
Right.
Right. So like
totally.
Eastsider, nonprofit advocate, artist and creative.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Plaza is a cultural institution.
Totally.
And so, and then you have access to a venue and good advice, right? So they were very encouraging from the start. They were like, hey, by the way, like there's many artists on staff here. And I was like, oh, wait, I'm not used to that. Right.
Yeah.
and they were like Chris Esparza was really, instrumental in saying, hey, here's how you book. Or I'd be like, hey, you look at layout and you just get it. Like you're like a wizard. And, and I would be curious and be like, hey, how do I produce? Like, can I be a producer?
Cool.
So I have like a less represented resume, but identity of wanting to produce. And the elements are all the same. I wanted a black and brown vendor market.
Yeah.
And this was like before I hadn't even seen it. I remember being a little bit nervous around naming that. Like, is that going to be received well? Are people going to understand my intention?
Right.
Is it going to look exploitative in nature or whatever I was in my head about
it? Yeah.
But I said, no, like, we don't have great black African American representation in San Jose.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a vendor market at every show that I have music and art in. And I'm not going to charge a fee. To this day, I've not done it, and I understand why people have to. So I'm not knocking any producer or organizer who does.
Sure.
But to me, it was not about me just putting on a concert. So Color Me Gold was really like the intent to bring like local talent to the forefront visual and musical talent, and to allow like everyone to collaborate and convene and to create a little ecosystem.
Yeah.
So all the vendors like that I first, and I've done like three of them so far, they like cross-pollinated. And yeah, I said, hey, totally. Can we all jump on a Zoom? Because like we're missing some of the connective tissues here when we do these things.
Yeah.
Like y'all should all know each other.
Right.
Because how do we make kind of radical pendulum swings? Like it means like I start going to your events, I support you, yeah. I share what I paid at this vendor rate.
Yeah.
And then I kind of saw that like, wait, there's something here. The artists are now collaborating. Francisco and Elba have been live painters at every one that I've done. And then the talent. And so like I in some ways, and I'm not going to take credit for it, but in some ways I just really wanted to create a container
yeah.
that would foster collaboration for the local ecosystem. And
yeah.
Color Me Gold was my attempt at that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So then, okay, so then let's get to the naming of Francis Experience, because it's your middle name, but there was some, you know, because uh-huh. you're kind of, yeah. So talk about that, like how you came up with that
okay.
kind of naming.
Yeah, and yeah. Nobody knows this provocative, Daniel. So, okay, so I'll answer this, and then I have a question for you that I have to get out.
Oh, you're going to ask me a question?
Oh, I got multiple questions for
okay,
you, Daniel.
Okay, we'll do that.
For the people.
For the people.
Inquiring minds.
Okay.
Okay, so Francis Experience. My full name is Jonathan Francis Borka. Now, the story goes that my dad and mom fought over what to name me.
Okay.
My dad wanted Francis, and my mom wanted Francisco.
Okay.
And so my dad won out legally.
Okay.
But I didn't know that. So actually, as a kid, my mom would say Francisco.
Right.
Only when she was mad, of course. Jonathan Francisco yeah, Borka.
Yeah. yeah.
Get over here. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so I literally kind of actually thought
that Francisco was it.
Was yeah. my middle name.
Yeah.
And so post college is really when I like started sharing musical content on my social media. I had never done it. I hid it before.
Yeah.
So my IG I mentioned earlier was originally private because I was like, you know what? I want an outlet to be creative.
Yeah.
And so Francis Experience was, so Francis, they're both layered. Francis was my way to embrace myself. It was a reminder to say you shouldn't be ashamed of anything that you are or anyone yeah. who you are.
Did you felt ashamed to be called Francis rather than Francisco?
Yeah, I think
not so much because the Mexican identity versus the Filipino identity, but just what was
the, yeah the pater- the oh, not the for- not the cultural but the paternal. So okay. I think I kind of oh, okay. started. I think I built up this complex of like I'm proud to be of my mom. Like oh, and yeah, I had a good relationship with my dad. My dad's a really good guy, sure. but I was like,
but still subconsciously the
for sure
absent father absent,
I mean,
affects
yeah.
us.
And yeah. and like yeah. my mom raised like three first generation college yeah. students, and we're all like sure. humbly we're all serving community yeah. in different ways, right?
Yeah, there's emotional connection to moms uh-huh. in general.
Yeah,
but then in addition, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's why it was more the Francisco, and so dealing with the Francis.
Was my way to kind of, yeah, well, it was my way to kind of merge, grow yeah. beyond that complex that I had.
Sure.
That was like, I love everything, mom, hate everything, dad.
Totally.
It was like, no, yeah. you know what? I need to be proud of who I am, period.
Yeah.
Right? So Francis was kind of the homage and a reminder to love who you are.
Yeah.
No matter what, the good, bad, the ugly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Experience kind of relates to what I tried to start at 2019, what I've carried as a
yeah.
performing artist identity. I never wanted it to be about me. I know I'm loud and obnoxious and I have an ego like many people, but it's not about me. I wanted to create an experience with the audience. I wanted yeah. people like the middle-aged big band lover, mm-hmm. the white couple in the poetry spaces, the
yeah.
POC kid who loved hip-hop and loves Nas and Tupac. Yeah. I wanted these people to share space.
Yeah.
And I wasn't trying to be grand. That's why you don't find it anywhere written. But it was like,
yeah.
I think they can all share space in a meaningful way. And
yeah,
I think
totally.
They're more alike than different, right?
Yeah.
So Experience was kind of like a reminder for myself, don't get a big head.
Yeah.
Like stay. And that wasn't
so
really
much
a thing.
As being, so it's not so much as being performative,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think it's come back to your community
mm-hmm.
idea, right? It's
mm-hmm.
like the audience
mm-hmm.
is such an important part mm-hmm. of art, right, and
yeah,
craft.
Yeah.
So I can see you, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's part of your ethos of who you are, mm-hmm. right? It's like a
yeah,
community
yeah.
and that experience, yeah.
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 Yeah, I there's been enough where I'm starting to see that, oh, wow, like I'm starting to believe it. I think I wear it on my sleeve,
yeah.
but I'm starting to see it. Like when you see kids stand up and dance,
yeah.
like at the Museum of Art, I did a show one day, and there was like three or four girls who stood up and danced, and Robin Treen was so kind. She was like, you didn't shoo them away. Like, what a serene moment. I was like, I got off stage. Like, this is like the best gig I've done.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's cool, yeah.
Or like when, like the very first show in 2019 at Tabard Theater, it was very raw, but it sold out. There was 100, they had to add seats. It was 149 cool. seats for my first production. And I saw people hug who didn't know each other. And that to me, that told me that like, wait, what I could wear myself better as a performing artist is what I know as a kid. My life lesson that music and art changed my life. I would have gone a different avenue, I promise you, Daniel. If not for those albums my mom gave me and starting to write, I would have, I very much could have gone a different avenue. And so in a way, I kind of just hope, and without naming it, like I kind of hope that I can, my art can be a space that convenes people, that makes people feel good, that fosters collaboration.
Okay, then let's, that's awesome. So then let's take a look at Jonathan Francis Borca 10 years from now. What, like as you're talking about what your, these passions that you have, what does it look like, would you say? What would be the ideal scenario for you?
Creatively or musically or?
You choose.
Yeah, so I think what I've bolstered better in the last 4 years is advocacy in the arts, right? So I very much care about paying artists, and I think it's why maybe I've collaborated with people who I think are like personal heroes, right? It's because they, I think it's because they know my intentions are good. And that I've never asked for a favor, and that I've paid thousands of dollars out of pocket because I don't believe in not paying creatives. I just don't. It's not a, something I want to adopt. I wear it as a value. So like, and I'll give an example of that, then I'll answer the question. But like, you know, not every, and there's always caveats, but if a friend is like, hey, don't worry, Jonathan, I know you're producing this event. You probably don't have a ton of money. You got a modest grant. Don't worry about it. And I said, wait, we need to shift our paradigm in how we think about how we pay artists, because if it's a value for me, it's not even about you. It's not even about, and like Elba, I remember Elba being so generous with her time, and she's like one of my heroes, right? Like, no, hey, that's more than we're used to. I go, no, like Elba, like this is what I can pay you. Like, this is a grant that I got. I need to pay you this. And in fact, you deserve double this. And so I started to make that a very consistent message, that it's not negotiable because it's my value, right? And honestly, I want to give credit to Erin Salazar. I can't remember the exact framing, but I was on her board. And that's where my will started churning around like fostering advocacy and pay equity for artists and creatives. She said something to the tune of like, no, we won't pay artists with just marketing. Like, I believe that you always have to. And so, so I kind of adopted that as a value. Now, there's always caveats. If you're doing things for nonprofits or first time, like, I'm not saying we should demonize any institution or organization. I just think if we really want to see pay equity, we need radical shifts. And so saying that paying an artist or a creative is a part of my identity, that's a radical shift, right? So I've done advocacy, I think. I'm an arts commissioner, right? Not because of my music, because of my relationship with the council member. Also, Magdalena Carrasco appointed me.
Well, you and you worked with her before, right? Or you were part of her, like, what do you call it when someone's running? I don't know.
Like a campaign?
Yeah, were you part of the campaign?
You know what? I would say more like I volunteered for her. And she has always been super warm to me. Like, I remember doing a couple cleanups, and I do remember, like, volunteering some time for her campaign. But it was all relationship-based, right? So.
But that's, like, the advocacy, the community building, the connection with the music and the paying artists, and, you know, and, like, even, like, you know, that's a in the political realm. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of. There's a lot of tentacles to Jonathan Borca.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Jeez. We need to cut off some of those tentacles. But but I would say to kind of
answer. 10 years,
To answer your question.
It,
to me, it's important to hold now my artistic practice in tandem with my advocacy.
Okay.
Because I love this stuff. Like Dan, I'm happy. Like, work is hard. And you guys know this, right? You guys work incredibly hard, and you have a small but mighty team. SV Creates has a small but mighty team. And so to me, I just do it really for myself. And now I'm happy that like the new identity is like, hey, like what would happen if I stood on my merit of my artistic practice more? If I stopped shying away from this light, if I stopped saying, don't worry about it, if I started applying for grants and emerging artist awards, because it's really my advocacy and professional relationships that have maybe propelled me in circles that I feel a little underqualified in. Versus like, hey, what could I do? Like, could I take that original idea of 2019, do it at the San Jose Museum of Art, and have people leave there on a Friday and feel something? Whether you feel happy, whether you feel understood, like nothing makes me happier than a very specific, genuine compliment. Someone says, hey, what you wrote about your nephew, like I cried.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, what? Because I experienced that with my son.
Yeah.
And that to me is my primary motivator. I ain't going to get rich. I don't want to get rich if I can pay people fairly, which I think I always try to do.
Yeah. That's cool. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I know that, you know, even your name, you know, dealing with your identity, right? Mm-hmm. Mexican, not Mexican enough, not
Filipino
enough, not East Side enough, not, you know, Bellarmine enough, you know what I mean?
Yeah, those kind
of things.
Yeah.
And then now I feel like, so like you were kind of been dealing with that idea. Now it's like the identity of like the community builder activist and the artist. Right?
Yeah. And
so maybe this is, you know, like the journey. How old did you say? You're like 36?
36.
So you're like, I think there is like a thing when you get to like in your 30s where there's like a, you start to kind of understand like who you are. And so like you're getting a, like you're coming to a melding of, you know, the full you.
Yeah, you're perceptive. Like that's really true. I'm really thinking about like what grounds me, what makes me happy.
Yeah.
How do you think about longevity in those different identities? Like, like one test is like, are we able to go home to our loved ones and be in a good mood, right?
Yeah.
And so I really want to do that. I want to like have more balance between advocacy and work, and then the creative artists, and how I can maybe contribute in my own small way to like our local creative ecosystem.
Yeah.
That's it for me.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then Francisco, and then the question is going back to you. I've readopted just because I'm really good at bad branding. So I readopted Francisco as my middle name.
Yeah.
Because my nephew was
on
born.
On your resume.
And I That's
was like,
right.
And it made me confused because I was like, wait a minute. No, I thought his middle name was Francis.
That's right.
And now it's Francisco here. And I was like, no, I was even going to say in the beginning when I introduced you, I was going to say your middle name. And then I was like, well, I got to find out which. So
less than a year. Less than a year.
Okay. So.
Because my nephew was born. My sister is the first to have a kid of the three siblings.
Yeah.
And as a homage, like a subtle homage to me, she gave him Francisco as a middle name.
Oh, awesome.
So Santiago Francisco León Borca. It sounds like a Cuban revolutionary. So that's why I'm like, even though it's not my technical name,
how
I chose to identify growing up. I'm like, it would be so cool to kind of have like this Tocayo kind of culture that you see in Mexican households. Like, it'd be really special to share that with my nephew. And so now I'm starting to pen Jonathan Francisco Borca.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool. It's kind of like a full circle. And then now it's like, it's kind of like a way, you know, it's almost, it's a choosing to rest in who you want to identify rather than like, this is what I think I need to be. This is what I don't want to be. Oh, this is who I am. But now you're saying like, no, this is who I am declaring who I am. So it's kind of,
And thank you for packaging that. It's like, oh, that's full circle. I see how you've grappled with different things around identity. And to your listeners, like, that's okay. Like,
totally.
We don't need to give permission for them. It's a journey, baby. And it's individual's journey. So if it's confusing, which it really is, if it's confusing to others, like I would just say, that's okay. This is your journey and how you identify. No one can touch it. I can be Mexican enough if I choose to be.
Yeah,
I can be Filipino enough if I choose to be, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so back to you. So I find this is a...
I'm going to go all David Letterman and not answer.
We're going to find out. We're going to play high level chess right here, David.
Okay.
I have a wager with David, who's behind the cameras and the audio right now. Shout out to David. So I would say one thing I kind of noticed, I did my very first podcast with BQ, early mornings, late nights, and I was terrified. I actually avoided them before that.
Yeah.
So thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah.
I find that like y'all don't share enough about yourselves. So like what is your genesis story of content and how did the podcast kind of develop out of that?
Yeah, I'll do that. I will answer that without answering it.
Let's hear it.
No, I think that the podcast, and we don't talk about ourselves as much, but we're planning on doing a little podcast more about the magazine and stuff like that.
Mm.
Is that, you know, like you, my mission is to uphold others.
Mm.
And so for the podcast, even like in this kind of, David and I have even talked about it too. It's like, we don't want it to be like, we don't want like a long intro and we're talking about, oh, we're doing this and the podcast is doing, you know, we want to jump right in and know you. Right. Mm. And so that's kind of our thing. I mean, I think people are curious, and I think that if we were trying to be brand strategists, like we would like share more of us, because then people were like, oh, but I like the magazine because I like David and Daniel. Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wanted people to like the magazine because they're curious to know the people in our community more. It's not a like you.
So it's intentional.
It's not about
us. It's intentional.
It's not about us. Yeah. Right.
And is that derivative of the cultivator? Is that kind of some of what?
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to. Yeah. So the cultivator. Yeah, that came out because when I first started the magazine, people say, "Oh, you're the editor in chief," and like I'm horrible with words. I got severe ADHD and dyslexia, all that kind of stuff. So no, I can't take any credit for any of the words. And then they said, "Well, you're the publisher." And I said, "No, I know nothing about money, fundraising, making money, selling ads, none of that kind of stuff. Are you doing a magazine?" And they go, "Oh, you just like cultivate like the magazine." I go, "Yeah, I'm the cultivator." So that's where that came out. It's
okay,
like a little byproduct of, yeah.
See, I'm going to give you some of your own medicine. It almost feels like intentionally or unconsciously or maybe a secondary intention of like, well, if you're choosing to use your platform to help others, cultivator to me makes hella sense.
Yeah.
And I tend to like names that have multiple meanings, right?
Yeah, totally.
So I think that's fit. It sounds fitting to what,
yeah.
what you do.
It's nothing to do with pot or marijuana or
anything like that. Oh, I didn't even think that. Yeah.
Some people think that. They're like, oh, the cultivator, right on. And I'm like, So, hey, so then as we talk about this kind of stuff, thank you for asking questions about me. I appreciate
that. Of course, yeah.
And the magazine. But for you then, would you say if you had to, like I know like I have like a, personal mission statement for my life. Do you have something like that? Like a North Star-ish kind of thing that you come back to like, this is what I'm about?
Yeah, so I haven't formally written stuff out, but I've toyed with a couple messages on my different identities. I have like a professional one.
Yeah, okay.
And I have like a creative working mission.
Yeah.
Professionally it was very much around. And it's funny because I wrote it as like my LinkedIn intro.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's still there, but it was there for a very long time. It might still be there.
Yeah.
But it was like I want the world and the greater San Jose to see Eastside as I see it, which is beautiful,
awesome.
Which is gold. It's a gold mine because very much a part of my story is like a lot. I mean, there's a lot of in this. I'll speak for myself and some of my peers growing up, but. A lot of us had we were raised by, like, the woman influence in Eastside to me, you can't separate it.
Yeah.
And so I think about a really eclectic group of people. I've always felt safe. I've always felt like it was multicultural. Yeah. I've always felt like that's where work ethic and ingenuity and creativity came from. Like, Eastside to me has always been beautiful.
Yeah.
And so my personal work, another thread, has always been tied to Eastside. I've never not taken a job out of Eastside, actually, outside of the Downtown Association. That's the one exception.
Wow.
So that's my personal mission. I want my home to be looked at as beautiful.
Yeah.
And I want to say that when I hang up this career, whether it's in nonprofits or whatever else, that I just made it a little bit more beautiful than for others because it always has been.
Awesome.
My creative mission is like really leveraging different like cross-medium arts and performing arts spaces to bring together disparate or siloed audiences.
Yeah.
That's it.
Awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Good. Let's get to then what you're doing with the, because you received, it's a California, it's like some long acronym, California, something.
Humanities.
Yeah.
No.
And then so at First Fridays, you've been a three-part series that you're doing. It's Hip and Hop Hope.
Yep. That's it.
Yeah. That you're doing. One's already taking place, but there's two more that are coming up, one in April, one in May.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that, the vision of the hip. Well, are you just saying hip-hop, or are you saying hip-hope?
Hip-hope.
Hip-hope.
It could read either way because it's parentheses.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, so and thank you for that. I was excited to share about that
because
it feels like something that I'm truly proud of, and it feels like it's hitting all these kind of themes and intentions that we've talked about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did a show, a First Friday show. When was it? Like Cinco de Mayo, a couple years back.
Okay.
And again, big up to Robin Train. She's been a really strong ally in the creative space, and it was packed. So I put together a band. It was Miguel Leyva, Bennett Roth. I actually did a show with Brandon Walters because Gabby was unavailable. I think that might have been like maybe the first show ever or in recent years I've ever not done a show with Gabby.
Oh, yeah.
But Brandon Walters is incredible.
He's great. I didn't even know. I've seen he's done sound for us a couple different times at different things. I didn't even know he played drums. And
great
drummer.
And
then he was at this other event and he was playing. I'm like, dude.
Well, he's like the full package. I mean, he does a lot of things and he has such a great attitude. Yeah. So that aside, it was a packed house. So I think they could fit 125 seats. There was not an open seat. And then that's actually where the four or five little girls came up to stage and were dancing. And prior to that, I had set an intention for myself of what is the good context that your art needs to be in. Yeah. And I told myself, I didn't tell people because I didn't want to be hypocritical,
yeah, sure.
But I was like, I think I'm done performing at bars.
Okay.
I'm not the best rapper. I don't have double time. Like, I don't have the best stage presence. I can riff on the MCs who I think are great in San Jose, but I offer words, right? And messaging.
Yeah,
and okay. So I got kind of tired of the hustle of rapping at bars in San Jose.
Sure, yeah.
And I held off. I think I said no to like over 10 shows for sure.
Yeah.
And then after that one, I made a joke on the mic after the show because the energy was palpable. And I was like, hey, like, sounds like y'all had a good time. Like, tell the San Jose Museum of Art to have us back for a residency. And it was total cheeky joke,
yeah, sure,
right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then sure enough, San Jose Museum of Art came up to me after and was like, okay, send us a proposal.
Nice.
So I worked really hard on a proposal, yeah. and big ups to California Humanities. They funded the idea that I put forward, which you touched on now, and it's a three-part residency. And San Jose Museum of Art has never had a musical residence before,
yeah.
and I'm really proud of that because, like, in my heart of hearts, I still kind of feel like the insecure East Side
sure.
boy who didn't like to tell people that he rapped because people said it was ghetto, yeah. right?
Right?
And
right.
So to me, I was like, wow, like, I can't even deny it, like. No one is my friend here. They believe in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, I got a three-part funded. The first one was in that following November with Mighty Mike. This one coming up next Friday, so this might be recorded after, but it's going to be with Rosana Alvarez. And then the last one in May, so May 5th, they're all first Fridays, is going to be with Shaka Campbell. And so that's really, yeah. like, the next iteration of these things that I'm trying to do, cross-medium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poetry.
Yeah.
Music.
Nice.
Intentional themes and colors. So I mirrored the color theme. So, like, the first one was yellow. This one
okay.
coming up is green.
Okay.
And the last one is going to be blue.
Yeah.
And those are just, like, guidelines for people to curate their own art.
Yeah.
So, like this upcoming month, Rosana, like, she's incredible. Rosana Alvarez, co-founder of East Side Magazine,
yeah.
and does a bunch of things. But she's such a wordsmith.
Yeah.
I actually wrote a poem.
Oh, yeah.
And mentioned her. I was like, what
oh,
if,
yeah.
imagine a world in which we all spoke in poetry like Rosana.
That's awesome.
And so
yeah,
funny
yeah.
enough, she's going to be performing with me, right?
Yeah, that's cool.
And so, yeah.
And she has a book out, too. Like,
yeah,
think,
that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember the name. Unbraided or something.
Yes. Yeah, so,
okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, maybe we can link it or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, like, yeah, she even Rosana was like, hey, tell me more about this theme. Like, oh, happily. Like, green can mean a lot of things. Here's a couple layers to it.
Yeah.
You know, whether green is nature. Green is a feminine energy. Green could be rebirth.
Yeah.
Also, in certain cultures, green could be money, envy.
Yeah.
And so it's never my intent to, like, chokehold
yeah.
art, but to give
people
more intentionality to play with.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's cool. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first Friday in April and the first Friday in May is...
Mm-hmm. April 3rd and May 5th.
Yeah.
Those are all free shows.
Awesome.
So... They do prefer that you register online. It helps them
yeah.
with predicting seats.
Yeah.
The San Jose Museum of Art holds First Fridays that have free access for anybody.
Yeah.
So
cool.
They open at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most people know it in San Jose, but it's truly worth checking out. It's very family friendly as
yeah,
well, which I love.
Yeah. The people that are close to you, like, what would be a word that they would describe you with?
Crazy. Just kidding.
crazy.
That's a good question.
If I talk to Jessica or Vanessa from the plaza.
Big heart, hardworking, compassionate. I think Jess one time said, you know, Jonathan's a force. And I remember that, like, really landing in almost an emotional. I was like, damn, like, this
oh, yeah.
is someone who
yeah.
who is, like, a professional. Professionally, I look up to Jessica. I always have. And
yeah.
so, like, for her to even say, like, wait, no, you got to believe in yourself a little more, and here's all the opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, they made me deputy director,
yeah.
right? And I was like, wait, I don't feel like I'm qualified for this job. So maybe humble. Would be, but that,
yeah, yeah.
that feels like counterintuitive to name yourself
no,
humble.
No, that's good. Yeah, no.
Grounded.
Good. Okay. All right. This is good. What's like on your playlist these days? What are you listening to? What's kind of like the tune, the music that you're kind of like listening to?
Yeah. Okay. So this is maybe not a sexy pick, but I'm a really big fan of, like, neoclassical or new classical music. So even more than, like, I go through bouts of hip hop.
Sure.
Just because also, like, a lot of the, like, you got to backpack or go back in the golden era to find, in my opinion, to find, like, consistently good hip hop. But Olafur Arnolds is a, he's a pianist who does kind of this, like, really interesting take on classical music. So it's kind of, like, newer.
All right.
Love his stuff. I listen to everything he puts out there. I listen to, if you're into like thematic music or scores for movies, this might be for you. If you're not, you'll probably hate it. But
do you listen to that like while you're working or something like that, or working out, or just
yeah? So working and prior to sleep. So it's actually a ton of I listen to podcasts daily.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just there's something about like hearing a cello and a piano that like. I think it's like a deeper divinity or language or communication. Yeah. So like when you hear, this is another kind of working theory I have, when you hear some music that might sound like melancholy or feel sad for people, I actually think it's not. I just think we're humans who are limited by our language. So what you feel is greater than the emotion we attach to it.
Yeah.
And so I don't listen to Olafur Arnolds because I like being sad. I listen to it because I'm like, well, I just feel. I feel more revigorated. Yeah, it makes me think better. And so. What? Back to you. What are you listening to?
Okay. I go through time periods. Mm. So I was like just listening to Post Malone's new thing.
Oh, and then cool.
Rodrigo. Mm. What's her name? The girl. Like my I know my kids talk about that. Olivia Rodrigo. So I was listening to that. And then, but then I always go back to like either some old stuff, like I go through these spells, and then I, for whatever reason, now it's like Fleetwood Mac's Rumors album.
Oh, yeah.
I keep coming back to that. Like, for a while, I was going back to Pink Floyd just because I wanted that kind of like headspace of that. Mm-hmm, so I'd dip into like all this kind of new stuff and then be like, but I just can't get away from this kind of old classic rock in a way.
Tried and true.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah.
Is there any genre that you won't dabble in?
I'm not a big country guy. Mm-hmm. Like even Beyonce's new song, it does seem a little too country for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not a big country in general. I haven't been, unless it's like old weird stuff like Patsy Cline. Do you know what I mean? Like like really like sad and like
Okay, good.
All right, have you read anything? Any books recently? Fiction, nonfiction?
I've been on a... I've admittingly been on a big reading drought, and it really is an intention to carve out. Like I just feel like you read, you just But you know what? It's not a good excuse. You make time for the things that you do. Look at a lot of the things you do, right? Yeah. So to me, I need to get back to it. I'll tell you the last memoir that I read that I loved. But yeah, we got to find time to read. If anyone can, it gets harder and harder in the digital world, social media. But I need to get off Instagram and shave 30 minutes off of social media just to read. Because I promise, I don't know if this is true for you, but I imagine if we all just read, the world would just be a better place.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, the what it does, I think, physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, you know, just like it does, it's different. And it's even different. I have friends who do books on tape. I still think it's different when you're looking at. It slows you down. But anyways, so what was the last memoir?
Okay, so I have a bunch that I've not fully read. And like my new I'm really liking memoirs right now. And this is an old read, so this is years ago, but this is the one I read and couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
It's When Breath Becomes Air.
Okay.
I'll probably butcher the description, but it was like a medical physician or surgeon who was like in the most competitive field for, I want to say, UCSF.
Okay.
And it kind of has this really interesting... foil of him becoming that and then he himself getting diagnosed with stage 4 or 3 cancer.
Okay. Wow.
And so it's fascinating for a lot of reasons, but it deals with like themes of more morbidity. What is life? What does it mean to go from here to be on the opposite spectrum?
Totally.
And I really like books that are written in sort of, because I like to write, but that have kind of a pretty writing style. And he has a really cool writing style.
Yeah. Is there a favorite author that you have? Like
probably Dr. Seuss Daniel. No,
that's right. Dr. Seuss rocks, man.
No, not front of mind. I got to get back into practice because I think the things that I thought I liked in my 20s,
sure.
I'm like, no, they're a chore. You should pick up something and you should just feel captured by it.
Yeah. So I've done that. I've like done same, books same with where you. I go through and I read through and I get like halfway through and like, I just screw it, free it. I put it down. Like, you know, get rid of it.
I read like a match on dry grass which was like this really fascinating case study of autonomous schools, which was pre-charter schools.
Okay.
And San Jose has like chapters on it. And I'm like, oh, this checks San Jose, local, Eastside, and all these things that I was into. And I and I realized like, no, it's just, it feels like a chore. It feels like homework.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's cool. All righty. So I guess we got to end it. I feel like I was going to ask you one other question, but I can't think of it. So we'll just end it right there. So why don't you tell all of our wonderful listeners about, give the dates of Hip Hope so they can get nice and clear, and all your Instagrams and websites and emails and
the shenanigans. My send me cash. I take IOUs, cashier checks. First, I just want to thank you, Daniel, David as well. Like, you guys are a small but mighty team. The fact that you're leveraging your platform for creatives is really special. There's not enough movers and shakers in San Jose, and I truly mean it. Deepest sincerity. Like, thank you for this space. This is really great. So the dates on the San Jose Museum of Art, there's two parts remaining depending on when this recording comes out. April 3rd is the next one, which is next Friday. It'll be a different time by the time y'all see this. That'll be with Rosana Alvarez. And then May 5th would be with Shaka Campbell. That is the final part of the Museum of Art. Again, doors open at 6. Music starts at 6:45, goes through 9. My Instagram handle is Francis, FRANCIS _ experience. Very confusing, but now you know why. And other than that, like, if there's ever a chance for me to collaborate or to connect or to convene people, that's very much part of my identity. That isn't about me. And so if anyone hears that, please reach down. I'm available.
Yeah, cool. Right on, man. Thank
you,
Francis. Cheers.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you for listening to the Content Magazine podcast. Follow us on social media at Content Mag. Become a member and help us to continue to tell the stories of the South Bay creatives. This episode's music is 408 by Jack Pavlina. Follow him on Spotify and also on his Instagram at Jack Pavlina Music.